votes to cause the official Democrat to win. I just needed to find a third party that would have me. Since I hate the government, and the libertarians hate the government, I figured that's my party. Except the thing is, the local libertarians' opposition to government is totally focused on one small aspect of the government, the drug laws. Until going through several weeks of negotiations with the Connecticut Libertarian Party over their pro-drug legalization stance, my position on drugs was to refuse to discuss drug legalization until I don't have to pay for the food, housing, transportation, and medical care of people who want to shoot up all day. It's not like we live in the perfect libertarian state of nature, with the tiny exception of those pesky drug laws. We live in a nanny state that takes care of us from cradle to grave and steals half our income. I kept suggesting to the local libertarians that we might want to keep our eye on the ball. One of the libertarians' other big issues is privatizing Yosemite. Seriously. In theory, our areas of agreement should have included, among other things, eliminating the Department of Health and Human Services, eliminating the Department of Education, eliminating the Department of Commerce, eliminating the National Endowment for the Arts, eliminating the National Endowment for the Humanities, eliminating the Department of Agriculture, eliminating the Department of Housing and Urban Development, eliminating the Department of Transportation, and eliminating the progressive income tax and instituting a flat tax. Our sole area of disagreement was whether to abolish the drug laws before or after completing the above tasks. But that wasn't good enough for them. I was deemed not a true libertarian by the Connecticut Libertarian Party because my idea was to defer the drug legalization issue until we had made a little more headway in dismantling the nanny state. By the way, the national office of the Libertarian Party grasped this point and was only concerned about what I would say about their presidential candidate. I believe we could have worked something out, but that was at least a practical problem. While I'm sure someone who loathes the government would make a splendid president, I couldn't credibly pretend I thought either that Harry Brown had a real shot at winning or that a Gore presidency wouldn't wreck the country. The other evidence these Sherlocks found, contradicting my claim that I do too hate the government, was that in a computer search of my name plus conservative versus my name plus libertarian, there were only 400 hits with libertarian and over 1,000 with conservative. But of course, unless I throw a tantrum and demand a particular designation, I have no control over how I'm identified on television or anywhere else. For example, TV producers have an annoying predilection of calling anyone who is not a socialist a GOP advisor. I finally blew up at this uninvited designation, saying I only wished the GOP would take my blank advice. That ended the GOP advisor title. Once I was on a program with Angela Davis, who has run for president on the Communist Party ticket several times. I worked for a Republican senator one time for 2 years, and that's the extent of my involvement in partisan politics. Davis was identified as a community activist, and I was called a Republican lawyer. To be completely accurate, I don't call myself anything. As far as I'm concerned, I'm a middle-of-the-road moderate, and the rest of you are crazy. The final nail in my coffin was that I hadn't been attending the Connecticut Libertarian Party's meetings, which seemed rather incongruous to the concept of libertarianism. These people oppose organized government, but demand an organized libertarian party that will enforce party discipline like a Soviet commissar. In any event, I've changed my position on the drug legalization issue after conferring, interminably, with the libertarians on the matter. There's a joke about a Frenchman, an Englishman, and a Russian who are told they have only one day until the end of the world. The Frenchman says he will spend his last day with a bottle of Bordeaux and a beautiful woman. The Englishman says he will take his favorite sheepdog for a walk across the moors. The Russian says he will burn his neighbor's house down. I'm with the Russian. Consequently, since the Connecticut Libertarian Party has denied me my sole remaining goal of defeating Chris Shays, I've moved from being completely uninterested in drug legalization to being virulently, passionately opposed to it. See this space next week for why drug legalization is an incredibly dumb idea, the second in my new Irish Alzheimer's series.
Drug shills, September 14, 2000.
Like everyone else in America, I'd never really listened to the arguments of the drug legalization crowd since it's not going to happen. These are like people whose area of expertise is pottery in ancient Tibet. Their ideas could be completely spurious, but no one cares enough to bother arguing with them. Stupid argument number one. The first argument one always hears about drug legalization is, alcohol and cigarettes are at least as bad and probably worse than marijuana. Gary Johnson, governor of New Mexico, and only the most recent Republican to discover that the path to fawning media coverage is to adopt liberal positions, is quoted in just such a fawning article in the New York Times saying, "Last year, 450,000 people died from smoking cigarettes. Alcohol killed 150,000, and another 100,000 died from legal prescription drugs. How many people died last year from the use of marijuana? Few, if any. From cocaine and heroin? 5,000. I'll accept all the drug legalizers' lying statistics and demonstrate that their arguments are still stupid, but you have to say, someone who lies in formulating an argument is not to be trusted. And that figure on cigarette deaths is a bald-faced lie. The 450,000 figure refers to all smoking-related deaths. A smoking-related death is any death that, theoretically, could be connected to smoking, even if the person who died never came within a mile of a lit cigarette. Smoking-related deaths include emphysema, any respiratory disease, heart attacks, and a plethora of cancers. If an obese 99-year-old man dies of a heart attack while shoveling snow, his death would be listed as a smoking-related death. Under the methodology used by the American Cancer Society to come up with the statistics on smoking-related deaths, 504,000 people die each year from insufficient exercise, and 649,000 die from improper diets. Indeed, the books are so cooked on smoking-related deaths that a 1993 article in the American Journal of Epidemiology was able to show that by using the exact same methodology, smoking saves 277,621 lives each year. There are no serious studies of the long-term effects of daily marijuana use, but we know marijuana smoke is much worse for the respiratory system than cigarette smoke. The only reason you never hear about people dying from marijuana is that, well, for one, like the old-timer shoveling snow, a pot smoker who dies of emphysema is listed as a smoking-related death. But also, people don't smoke pot the way they smoke cigarettes. One reason for that is, marijuana is illegal. If people smoked pot as much as they drink and smoke, we undoubtedly would have a much better sense of the health consequences of sustained marijuana use, but by then it would be too late. Once people have spent a few decades smoking pot at restaurants, family gatherings, and football games, it's going to be a little hard to create a taboo around marijuana use. See, for example, prohibition. But even stipulating to the drug legalizers' phony statistics, let's assume alcohol and cigarettes induce dependency, ruin lives, cause disease, depression, countless traffic injuries and fatalities, and increase the incidence of homicide and suicide. This is supposed to be an argument for legalizing another drug like them? Stupid argument number two. Prohibition failed. No, it didn't. Prohibition resulted in startling reductions in alcohol consumption, over 50%, cirrhosis of the liver, 63%, admissions to mental health institutions for alcohol psychosis, 60%, and arrests for drunk and disorderly conduct, 50%. That doesn't mean prohibition was a good thing. Christ's first miracle wasn't turning wine into water. But prohibition is one of the strongest arguments against legalizing marijuana. The reason prohibition failed was that alcohol had become a respectable libation. It was part of the social fabric in high society and low. Once the genie is out of the bottle, so to speak, it's hard to put it back. Stupid argument number three. One of the leading libertarian arguments made for legalization is that drug use would decrease if drugs were legal because, I quote, the government just messes everything up. While it's hard to argue with that premise, one thing governments are really good at is criminalizing stuff. People like me hate the government because of the things it prohibits: earning money, flushing toilets, owning and developing property, and engaging in political speech. Not because the government isn't good at it. The idea that making an activity legal would reduce its incidence is preposterous. This is exactly like the Clintonian statement about wanting to make abortion safe, legal, and rare. The most effective way to make something rare is to make it illegal. It ought to stop you in your tracks that politicians like Gary Johnson want to legalize drugs so the government can tax drugs. Whenever politicians say they want to restrict something by taxing it, you know they're lying. The very fact that they are taxing it means they need people to keep doing it. Otherwise, they'd run out of revenue. Just as they are doing with gambling, the government is trying to horn in on a criminal enterprise. It never occurs to politicians to make government more like Microsoft. Successful capitalist enterprises they want to destroy. It's the Crips and the Bloods they see as a useful organizational model. Stupid argument number four. We've lost the drug war. We've lost the murder war, too, if winning is defined as total abolition. People persist in taking drugs because they want to. We don't have laws prohibiting what no one wants to do. Laws against drugs have surely reduced drug use, just as laws against murder and robbery reduced the incidence of murder and robbery. Stupid argument number 5. As aspiring pothead Governor Johnson puts it, half of what we spend on law enforcement, half of what we spend on the courts, and half of what we spend on the prisons is drug-related. Our current policies on drugs are perhaps the biggest problem that this country has. I won't dispute the governor's presumably apocryphal facts. We spend a lot of money enforcing murder and robbery laws, too. So what? It's supposed to be a disaster for the country that the drug laws keep a lot of people gainfully employed working for law enforcement and prisons? That doesn't mean we should randomly criminalize things to create jobs for prosecutors and prison guards, but the horrifying consequence of providing people with good jobs at good wages is not a strong argument for repealing drug laws. As an added benefit, the drug laws help rid the streets of people who are, by definition, the sort of people who are willing to break laws. Stupid argument number 6. The quintessential libertarian argument for drug legalization is that people should be allowed to do what they want with their own bodies even if it ruins their lives. But that's not true. Back on Earth, we live in a country that will not allow people to live with their own stupid decisions. Anne has to pay for their stupid decisions. We have to invest in our future by supporting people who freely choose to inject drugs in their own bodies and then become incapable of holding jobs, obtaining housing, and taking care of their children. So it's not really quite accurate to say drugs hurt no one but the user, at least until we've repealed the welfare state. And don't give me the now we'll have to regulate fatty foods slippery slope argument. Precisely because you can see a difference in eating a hamburger and smoking crack means there is a difference between the top of the slope and the bottom. That, in a nutshell, is why pure slippery slope arguments are always fatuous. Even John Stuart Mill said there were some things people could not be permitted to choose to do with their own bodies in a free society. The principle of freedom cannot require that he should be free not to be free. It is not freedom to be allowed to alienate his freedom. Drugs enslave people. Maybe cigarettes and alcohol do too, but that just brings us back to stupid argument number 1.
Capital punishment. April 1999.
The really totally appropriate setting for writing an article about dating in the nation's capital would be in my D.C. apartment, home alone on a Saturday night. By chance, however, I'll be in New York this weekend. By chance, I've been in New York every weekend for approximately the previous 147 weeks, give or take a few shuttle mishaps. But since all my stuff is in D.C., I do have to drop in occasionally. Consequently, I've become a minor authority on dating in Washington. Maybe not dating exactly, but one crucial element of any date, the ask. Boys in Washington don't know how to ask for a date. What they do is try to trick you into asking them for a date. They say, I know you're really busy, so call me when you'd like to go out to dinner. Or, call me when you're back in Washington. Or, my favorite, are we ever going to get together? What are you supposed to say to completely insane things like that? I've never figured that out, which is why these conversations tend to end in hostile silences. Call me when you'd like to go out to dinner isn't asking for a date. It's asking me to ask you for a date. For my male readers in Washington, asking for a date entails these indispensable components. An express request for a female's company on a particular date for a specific activity. Oh yes, and the request has to be made to the female herself. Roughly once every 2 weeks, I get a female on my answering machine asking me if I'd like to go out with some dumbass male friend of hers who's too afraid to call me himself. For those outside Washington, I'm not kidding. This isn't a screeching, hate-filled, anti-male screed. It's a screeching, hate-filled, anti-DC screed. There's no large sociological point about relations between the sexes here. It's Washington. I know this because while DC males are on my answering machine with vague announcements that they've called, I still get messages from boys in New York saying, for example, I have tickets for the opera next Friday. Would you like to go? If you're having trouble following the plot lines here, I never actually answer my phone. I sit at my computer listening to people leave messages and respond, if necessary, by typing out an email. Males in every other city know how to ask for dates, so it's not me, it's not feminism, it's not the millennium. I've begun aggressively inquiring of every female I come across. Pardon, but have you noticed that boys in Washington don't know how to ask for dates? The consistent response has been a raft of stinging denunciations too numerous to catalog here. If I were asking something preposterous like, say, have you noticed all the alligator carcasses in the street lately? I wouldn't be getting such emphatic affirmations every time. Recently, I asked a female on Capitol Hill about the phenomenon, and she said right off, as if I were a psychic, we were just talking about that on Saturday night. She had been talking about it in a mixed crowd and reported that the boys began hectoring the girls. Come on, this is the 20th century. You're modern women. You can ask for dates. I asked her if waiting for women to ask them for dates had worked for these guys. No, they just sit around with friends year after year waiting for their theory to play out. This is also how government programs are conceived and tested. So it makes perfect sense that only in Washington are males still waiting for action on the no-ask dating plan. In fact, the incapacity of the D.C. male to ask for a date is the perfect synecdoche for this whole pathetic city. First, there is a total absence of normal, civilized conventions in Washington. The customer is always wrong, the cabs don't have meters, and complete strangers ask for the sports section of your paper on the subway. In every real job I've ever had, it was standard for the boss to give a Christmas gift to the people who work for him. In Washington, minimum wage staffers take up a collection to buy Christmas gifts for the senator and chief of staff. There's a reason boys asking for dates is a convention of civilized society. Someone's going to have to face rejection. It may as well be the aggressive, testosterone-pumping hunter male. Speaking for myself, I'll take 69 cents on the dollar, or whatever the current feminist myth is, never to have to ask for a date. But the whole point of this convention is to reduce, if not eliminate, the need for rejection anyway. The entire dating system runs on implicit understandings. If the hunter male doesn't like a girl, he doesn't call. That's the end of it. If the hunted female doesn't like the boy, she's unavailable without good excuse 3 times in a row. No explanations, no hurt feelings. When you start fiddling with a centuries-old system like this, you're just asking for trouble. If you can't operate by covert signals, you're going to get horrifying, misery-inducing explanations. And if you ask a stranger for her sports section on the subway, you're going to get maced. Second, no one makes any money in D.C. From this, I deduce that it's important for young men to make loads of money. There may be grading aspects to 20 and 30-somethings earning gazillion-dollar bonuses, but at least it gives them the self-confidence to ask for a date. Third, TV is reality in Washington. Restaurants close at 8 p.m. There are a few really, really late-night places that stay open until 9 or 10, but even these sometimes close unexpectedly at 8. In addition to being always wrong, the customer is an impediment to the serious business of Washington, which is watching TV. So everyone is home watching TV all the time. Like most New Yorkers, I never had a TV, but I got one when I moved to Washington. The peculiar thing about watching TV after a long lapse is that you are actually aware of TV changing your perceptions of reality. I've started subconsciously associating men of the cloth with murderous Nazi conspiracies, for example. I've got a million more television-induced perception shifts, but the relevant one here is that females are invariably the sexual aggressors on TV. The typical romantic overture on the small screen is boy meets girl, girl drops dress. TV hasn't ruined me yet, though. My romantic fantasy is still this. Girl meets moving company guy. Girl moves back to New York.
What you could have read if you lived in a free country.
Take heart, young right-wingers. Just a few short years ago, I was nearly living in a box under the Brooklyn Bridge. For more than a decade, virtually no one would publish me. Even after actively soliciting articles from me, magazine editors always decided they were more interested in publishing conservatives in the abstract than in reality. Maybe a sensible conservative like David Gergen, who worked for Clinton, but not that nut Ann Coulter. I was the polar opposite of Maureen Dowd, who apparently has never written anything that was rejected. For the first few years my literary agent had me as a client, all she did was negotiate kill fees, which magazines pay writers for articles they've commissioned but don't publish, like a consolation prize. It's like a parting gift that a game show loser gets after they say, thanks for playing our game, and hustle you off the set. Turning lemons into lemonade, conservative writer George Gilder has managed to get kill fees from magazine after magazine for the exact same article. Interestingly, other than scholarly journals, the only two magazines that would publish me were Ronald Reagan's favorite publication, Human Events, even though it had to break a half-century no-girls rule to hire me, and John Kennedy Jr.'s George magazine. Even after I wrote my first New York Times bestseller, High Crimes and Misdemeanors, no newspaper in America big enough to be on LexisNexis would carry my syndicated column. In fact, so few papers carried it, I only earned a few $100s a month from that column. For tax mavens, that works out to about $6 after taxes. I would have made more money by delivering newspapers than by writing for them. Even my books got killed. After my second book, Slander, was killed by the publisher, I went months and months without possibility of publication, even as pre-publication orders were pouring in. I not only had no publisher, I had to pay back the book advance I had originally gotten from HarperCollins, owned by right-wing media magnate Rupert Murdoch, pretty much proving Al Franken's theory of a conservative media bias. Italics added to indicate sarcasm, Al. In other words, I had a somewhat different experience from that of Jason Blair, who was writing front-page articles for the New York Times before he had, in the strict sense, graduated from college. But then Crown Books came along and published Slander, and it was another hit. And then they published Treason, and it was my third hit. Now everything has changed. I live in a nice house. It is still the case, however, that except Human Events, no national publication will print my columns. And it is still true that no newspaper in America big enough to be on LexisNexis will carry my syndicated column. Apparently, the only people who want to read me are actual Americans. Liberals defend every manner of pornography and filth on the grounds that it's what the people want. Editors, we are constantly lectured, only want to sell newspapers. The only material too prurient to let the public read is anything written by a conservative. And I'm a conservative success story. If editors believe the general public has no interest whatsoever in hearing from a conservative, all of whose books were bestsellers, how many right-wingers out there have we never heard from at all? How many never had a Crown Books come along and publish them after a decade of rejection? How many switched careers or switched their politics? How many boxes can fit under the Brooklyn Bridge? Alas, we will never be among Cosmopolitan magazine's fun, fearless females, like Kate Harrington, February 2000, because as costume designer for last summer's smash hit The Thomas Crown Affair, she made the fearless move to dress Rene Russo in Celine and Halston. With no rich liberals to give us MacArthur Foundation genius grants, or to buy up radio stations for us after throwing minorities off the air in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, and San Francisco, conservative writers merely face starvation. On second thought, young right-wingers, abandon hope of ever being a writer. Become an editor. Until a few years ago, there was no alternative media that allowed conservatives to be heard. This generated terrific defensiveness. As an upstart insurgency fighting all organs of elite opinion, a lot of conservatives talk in the stilted, paranoid manner of people who believe they will be shot by the Nazi SS if their words are somehow misconstrued. Don't mention the blacks, but I just said Lincoln freed the slaves. People will misunderstand. Don't mention the Jews. I just said I supported Israel. Shh, liberals will say that's anti-Semitic. I never got the hang of being scared of liberals. The technical term for conservatives who are not afraid of liberals is unpublished. But my columns won't be put in a lockbox. The following columns are what editors didn't want you to see. Perhaps these columns are not as good as I thought they were, but on rereading them, I still think they're better than they are. So here it is, a right-wing Lollapalooza, Ann Coulter's private stock.
Cigar Aficionado.
On the basis of a recommendation from George Will, Cigar Aficionado, popularly known as Cigar, Fishing, and Auto, asked me to write a column on campaign finance reform a few years ago. This is what I submitted.
This congressman bought for you by the New York Times, May 27, 2000.
I'm toying with the idea of becoming an outlaw. You would, too, if your representative in Congress were Chris Shays, Republican of the New York Times. I won't bore you with his entire tedious and pathetic career, but just for starters, Shays was one of only five Republicans to vote against the impeachment of a lying, felonious president. I'm hopping mad about it, to the point that I want to commit an act of free speech against him. In a country that enshrined the right of free speech, political speech in particular, also known among constitutional cognoscenti as core First Amendment speech, this would be easy. I could take out television, radio, and newspaper ads detailing Mr. Shays' perfidy, or, if, say, I had a life, I could pay his political opponents to do it for me. But in this country, it's impossible for me to do that without becoming a lawbreaker, or at the very least, a suspect. Even if I hire a band of lawyers to advise me on navigating the narrow legal path to engaging in core First Amendment speech, I will undoubtedly be investigated, audited, and publicly accused of being a scofflaw. In the end, I might even be found to have broken a campaign finance law or two. The catch is that the whole point of my free speech would be, in a sense, to help Mr. Shays' opponent get elected. If Mr. Shays were pumping gas somewhere, I wouldn't feel compelled to run radio ads denouncing him for his political views. I want him to lose his job as my representative. The only way for that to happen is for his opponent to win. If his opponent is Mickey Mouse, I'm for Mickey Mouse. If I were to run ads attacking Shays, those ads would inevitably help Mickey Mouse, and my free speech would be portrayed as a thinly disguised campaign contribution to the Mouse campaign. Campaign contributions, you see, are strictly limited to $2,000 per person. Otherwise, we might end up with idiots in Congress, like Chris Shays. This is what happened when Texas businessman Sam Wiley ran television ads attacking John McCain just before the New York primary earlier this year. The New York Times immediately demanded an investigation by the Federal Election Commission of Mr. Wiley's subterfuge and secret sponsorship of the ads. Political speech should be left in the hands of responsible New York Times editorial writers. The Times identified such wanton free speech by a private citizen as a menace to the integrity of politics and a serious threat to the integrity of future elections. There was evidence, you see, that Mr. Wiley actually wanted McCain's opponent, George Bush, to win. And equally intriguing news that the ads were placed through an advertising agency with ties to Governor George Pataki, also believed by law enforcement officials to be a Bush supporter. So if you're tempted to engage in political speech, the only safe course is to run a wholly ineffective ad campaign that could not possibly persuade anyone to vote one way or the other. Any indication, for example, that I actually want Chris Shays to lose, or any communication with his political opponents, no matter how indirect, will constitute evidence of coordination, a secret campaign contribution to his opponent. Meanwhile, let's say I don't care about my country, politics, or civic affairs. All I want to do is make porno movies. Without limitation or consultations with fancy lawyers, I can spend $1 million producing speech of the Debbie Does Dallas variety. But if I want to engage in speech of the Vote Against Chris Shays variety, I can only spend $2,000. It's easier to pander obscenity in this country than it is to engage in core First Amendment speech. Advocates for campaign finance reform claim they have no problem with political speech, it's just the horrifying amounts of money being spent on campaign speech that bother them. Horrifying was the technical term used by one specialist, quoted in a recent Washington Post article on campaign finance reform. But saying you have a right to do something, and the government is merely placing limits on how much money you can spend doing it, isn't even a clever ruse. How about this? You have a right to engage in the free exercise of your religion, but can only spend $2,000 a year on it. Otherwise, rabbis, priests, and ministers might be bought. We'll call it religion finance reform. Yes, you're saying to yourself, but no one wants to bribe a man of the cloth. What are you going to get out of it? A quick path to salvation? Pah! Congress can screw your competitors, grant you a cartel, subsidize your business, create little welfare programs for the children that will send federal booty your way, or create legal bars to people suing you. Far be it from me to quarrel with the proposition that politicians are corrupt, but first of all, no law has ever been written that could stop the citizenry from trying to get at the $1.7 trillion of taxpayer money Congress doles out every year. Indeed, the only serious and workable solution to political corruption is for politicians to be worth substantially less. Until that time, though, even stipulating that politicians are corrupt, it still does not follow that suppressing free speech will make them any less so. The theory of campaign finance reform devotees is that if Congress would further limit speech by non-news media-owning citizens, any taxpayers who want to get some of that $1.7 trillion would at least not be able to do it by engaging in speech. That's really the theory. Citizens can bribe politicians by arranging favorable cattle futures trades, selling them stock and bonds at a loss, buying their houses above market price, or selling them houses below market price, building million-dollar pantheons in their names, hiring their wives and mistresses, sending them on exotic vacations, or fact-finding missions, and giving to their favorite charities. But the one way you can't bribe a politician is by engaging in free speech, at a cost of more than $2,000, saying, re-elect or defeat Senator Blowhard. Of course, for bribing politicians, nothing beats owning a newspaper. Newspapers like the New York Times have absolutely no limitations on running editorials exhorting, vote for Chris Shays, as that paper did in violation of an almost uninterrupted, century-long tradition of endorsing only Democrats. Nor are there any restrictions on how often the Times can run news articles describing Chris Shays as a moderate. Indeed, assuming a favorable editorial in the New York Times were worth only half as much as a half-page paid political ad in that newspaper, the New York Times gave Shays about $1 million in campaign donations in 1999 alone. To put this in perspective, Shays typically spends about $500,000 on his entire re-election campaign. It was a wise investment. Shays voted against almost every member of his party, but with the Times, on the not insignificant issue of a president's impeachment. Most strikingly, he repeatedly introduces campaign finance reform bills that would grant special rights to the Times and other newspapers to engage in political speech without contradiction by upstarts like Sam Wiley. I'm not saying free speech can't function as a bribe. I just think private citizens ought to be able to bribe politicians as easily as the New York Times does. Postscript. My Cigar Fishing and Auto editor responded with a long email suggesting that, instead of making the strong argument against campaign finance restrictions, I make the weak argument. To wit, I should complain that rich people can spend whatever they like on their own campaigns. It is a source of endless fascination to liberals that the rich can do things poor people can't. In retrospect, maybe it was a mistake to try to attack Bill Clinton in the pages of Cigar Aficionado. As I recall from the Star Report, Mr. Clinton has been known to enjoy a good cigar.
Wall Street Journal.
This was the only one of the rejected columns that was not solicited by the publication. A professor read my draft and insisted I submit it to the Wall Street Journal. I said the Wall Street Journal would sooner publish Jane Mayer, hate-mongering author of the Clarence Thomas Hatchett job, Strange Justice, than publish me. Then I remembered that the Journal did publish Mayer. I sent the column, and the Journal turned it down, explaining that they just weren't interested in the topic. A few weeks later, they asked someone else to write about the exact same topic. It was a good article, except for one tiny detail. It overlooked the fact that the central charge against Thomas Jefferson was actually disproved by DNA evidence.
Sally Does Monticello, June 21, 2001.
In a terrifically humiliating episode, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Joseph Ellis was recently exposed by the Boston Globe as an exotic Walter Mitty of the Ivory Tower. For years, he claimed he had gone to Vietnam in the 101st Airborne, had served under General William Westmoreland in Saigon, had been a rider on the Freedom Trail in Mississippi, beaten up by racist cops, and had been a high school football hero, once scoring the winning touchdown, among his other fanciful claims. None of it was true. Faced with the evidence, Ellis was forced to apologize for having let stand the assumption that he had been telling the truth. You might say Ellis had fancied himself the Thomas Jefferson of the 20th century, except that Jefferson's reputation is shot, thanks in part to Joseph Ellis. Between NOM flashbacks and Freedom Rider reunions, Ellis co-authored the groundbreaking 1998 report titled Jefferson Fathered Slave's Last Child. You might remember this report if you weren't on the moon when it was released. It was the Clinton defenders' giddiest gotcha moment. It was unveiled to instant acclaim just weeks before the House impeachment vote on William You-Know-Who Clinton's impeachment stemming from his sexual affair with an intern. As Ellis put it, it is as if Clinton had called one of the most respected character witnesses in all of U.S. history to testify that the primal urge has a most distinguished presidential pedigree. Ellis said the new testing proved, beyond any reasonable doubt, that Jefferson had a long-term sexual relationship with his mulatto slave. As author of the award-winning American Sphinx, The Character of Thomas Jefferson, and a Vietnam veteran, Ellis spoke with some authority on the matter. We're still waiting for the publication of American Liar, the Joseph Ellis story. An editorial in the Washington Post promptly denounced Jefferson for carrying on a private sexual relationship with an inherited young slave girl, and proclaimed that having sex with slaves smacked of racism. Separate and apart, evidently, from merely holding them as property. It was as if Jefferson was morally obligated to carry on exploitative relationships with Latina, Asian, and Caucasian chattel as well, just for the sake of appearances. USA Today reported, Thomas Jefferson owned lots of slaves and had lots of sex with at least one of them, Sally Hemings. According to new DNA tests, Jefferson sired at least one child, Eston, through that union, and probably six others. Unfortunately for the gang of harpies defending Clinton, proof of a Jefferson-Hemings liaison was as fanciful as Professor Ellis's military service. 2 months after the report's findings had been published in every news outlet where English is spoken, a correction had to be issued. Ellis's co-author, pathologist Eugene Foster, the actual scientist, admitted to the British science journal Nature that they had not proved Thomas Jefferson fathered any children by Sally Hemings. "We never proved it," Foster told the Washington Times. "We never can, we never will." What they meant to say was, Jefferson could have fathered Slave's last child. And it also was not true that Jefferson met Hemings while serving in the 101st Airborne during the Vietnam War. The press was not as interested in the "we lied" correction as it had been in the original inflammatory and false charge. Less than half a dozen newspapers admitted that the report had traced the paternity of Hemings' last child to any one of several Jefferson men. Besides Jefferson, there were 25 Jefferson adult males alive when Hemings conceived her last son, seven of them at Monticello. Many scholars consider Jefferson's younger brother, Randolph, a more likely suspect on account of his frequent socializing with the slaves. While Jefferson was busy entertaining prominent international visitors in the main house, Randolph would generally retire to the slave quarters. As Randolph was described by one slave, "Old Master's brother, Mass Randall, was a mighty simple man, used to come out among black people, play the fiddle, and dance half the night. Hadn't much more sense than Isaac." Isaac was one of the slaves evidently not known for his intellectual prowess. Today we would say he hadn't much more sense than just a suitor. Stunningly, the Ellis study actually exonerated Jefferson on the principal charge against him. The Hemings rumor was based on two sources, the contemporaneous attacks of a political enemy and the oral history passed down through Hemings' descendants and lovingly promoted by 20th century Clinton defenders. In 1802, muckraking alcoholic journalist James Callender, who had earlier served prison time for his particular brand of journalism, tried to blackmail Jefferson into appointing him postmaster at Richmond. When blackmail failed, Callender publicly accused Jefferson of miscegenation with Sally Hemings, or as Callender put it, a slut as common as pavement. He wrote of Jefferson, "It is well known that the man keeps and for many years has kept as his concubine one of his slaves. Her name is Sally. The name of her eldest son is Tom. His features are said to bear a striking, though sable, resemblance to those of the president himself." Thus began the rumor of President Tom, as Callender called Jefferson's putative illegitimate son. The oral history passed down through Hemings' children also pointed to Tom as Jefferson's child. From there, it was simply assumed that if Tom was Jefferson's son, the rest of Hemings' children were his too. Now here's the crescendo. The pre-impeachment Get Jefferson study specifically proved that Tom, at least, was not fathered by Jefferson. After testing six different genetic lines from President Tom, the DNA tests ruled out any Jefferson as the father. The study that allegedly proved Jefferson fathered child with slave had scientifically disproved the centerpiece of the accusation. But that wasn't the title of Professor Ellis's report, nor was it mentioned in the blanket news coverage of the report's false accusation against Jefferson. In fact, there was no news coverage, not a single article, on the amazing fact that the DNA study had actually exonerated Jefferson of fathering Tom. To repeat, the famous Tom, the Tom who got the whole reputation-blackening ball rolling, was proved by DNA evidence not to be fathered by any Jefferson. The pre-impeachment report had to fall back on an entirely new suspect in order to smear Jefferson, Hemings' last-born child, Eston, whose claims to paternity are far more incredible. Eston, the only Hemings child who could be tied by DNA to some Jefferson, was born in 1808, when Thomas Jefferson was 64 years old. Randolph, the Jefferson fiddling and dancing with the slaves, was 12 years younger. But more significant, Eston was conceived 5 years after Callender made his scurrilous accusation against Jefferson. In order to implicate President Jefferson, the theory must be that Jefferson waited 5 years to start engaging in the depraved conduct Callender accused him of back in 1802. Amazingly, years after the principal charge against Jefferson was disproved, the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation issued a report purporting to acknowledge that Jefferson fathered all six of Hemings' illegitimate children. Katie Couric is one of the renowned historians on the board of the Monticello Foundation. Guided tours of Monticello today include the provably false information that Jefferson fathered all of Hemings' children. The Monticello Association, a group of Jefferson descendants, invited the Hemings descendants to join Jefferson family reunions at Monticello. Apparently, there are limits to oral history. For example, most people would prefer to be descendants of a former president, rather than, say, descendants of his half-wit brother. If anyone ought to have recognized the possibility of self-aggrandizement in such oral histories, you'd think it would have been Professor Ellis.
Good housekeeping.
For about a year after each one of these happy experiences in publishing, I would refuse to waste 1 second writing anything for any publication without an ironclad promise that whatever I submitted would be published, even if it was 20 pages of all work and no play makes Anne a dull girl. But time would pass, a new opportunity would arise, and I'd tell myself, this time it will be different. And then the same thing would happen all over again. To put it in terms comprehensible to a women's magazine editor, I was like a battered wife clinging to a series of abusive publications. The last time was in the fall of 2003, when Good Housekeeping asked me to write about a proverb. Inasmuch as their proverbs were the kinds of sayings that make you want to kill yourself, a friend in need is a friend indeed, and the early bird catches the worm. This assignment was not exactly my cup of tea, but it was no less heinous than writing about feminist legal theory, and at least this column would be published. Or so I thought. Now that I had 3 bestsellers under my belt, I figured magazine editors were finally willing to throw caution to the wind and publish Ann Coulter. Not only that, but at about the same time I was writing my proverb column, British Good Housekeeping ran a consumer review of vibrators. Could I say anything racier than that? Why, yes, I could. Here's the column that was too hot for Good Housekeeping.
If you sup with the devil, use a long spoon. Fall 2003.
A few years ago, when I was on radio promoting my book about the Clinton scandals, High Crimes and Misdemeanors, a woman called in with the standard DNC talking point informing me that everybody does it. To wit, all men cheat on their wives. People who say everybody does it are announcing nothing more than the implacable fact that they do it. As Edmund Burke said, he who accuses all of mankind convicts only one. But this caller didn't have the glib, vaguely contemptuous tone of the typical Clinton defender. She was on the verge of tears. The pain in this woman's voice made clear that the everybody was not her, but her spouse. I'm not clinically trained to deal with despair, but I did tell the caller that she was wrong, and she needed to start hanging with a new crowd. In fact, according to the only serious, long-term, scientific study of the sexual behavior of Americans ever performed, 75% of married men and 85% of married women have never been unfaithful. Never. This is according to a study out of the University of Chicago titled The Social Organization of Sexuality, completed in 1994. And consider that that figure includes couples who are separated or headed toward divorce court. And further consider that residents of Manhattan and Malibu were included in the category Americans. But you can be sure that in any town, the 20% of adulterers will know one another. Alcoholics hang around alcoholics. Drug addicts hang around drug addicts, liars hang around liars. Vices of a feather flock together. This is a great tip for figuring out which of your friends are liars and cheats. They are the ones who seem to know a curiously large number of people who lie and cheat. But it's also a warning to keep those friends at a distance. It's hard enough to resist temptation, the one thing Oscar Wilde said he could not resist, without also feeling like you were the only person on earth being asked to engage in the Herculean task of not committing a mortal sin. When every fiber of your being wants to do something, and the only thing stopping you is the knowledge that it would be wrong, it's not going to make it easier to know that a lot of your friends apparently do not care that it's wrong. It's especially not going to be easy if the ones who do not care seem no worse for the wear. This is part of what is so corrupting about television shows and Hollywood movies that show gorgeous people with an endless supply of witty lines and fabulous clothes engaging in wildly promiscuous behavior. Americans' friends are NBC's friends. If you think people can distinguish between TV characters and real-life friends and neighbors, consider the firestorm of indignation Dan Quayle ignited when he made the incontrovertibly true point that the scriptwriters for the fictional television character Murphy Brown were not performing a public service by portraying the heroine as having a child out of wedlock. Apparently, a lot of people believed Murphy Brown was a real person, and Dan Quayle had just cruelly insulted her. A decade later, when the writers for Friends wrote an out-of-wedlock pregnancy for a popular character, no one made a peep. Perhaps the greater disservice of Hollywood movies is their cartoonish villains. In real life, I promise you, the devil will look more like Julia Roberts than Snidely Whiplash. Evil does not arrive with a flashing neon sign. Mephistopheles, Lucifer, Satan, for eternal damnation, apply here. Evil arrives packaged as a winsome movie about a long-legged brunette who manages to marry a rich, handsome bachelor and live happily ever after, all by turning tricks on Hollywood Boulevard. There's a reason Beelzebub is known as the Prince of Lies. Evil presents itself like a beautiful banquet. That's why Adam and Eve were tempted with a delicious-looking apple instead of a spoonful of castor oil. Satan takes the form of gorgeous actresses, successful politicians, and pop icons cavorting across the gossip columns, subliminally exhorting the reader, "Be like me, don't be a prude. This is how the glamorous people live." But as in Wilde's picture of Dorian Gray, the sinner's beauty conceals a soul growing uglier by the minute. People don't commit acts of great evil or great courage out of thin air. Character is developed out of a lifetime of choices. Almost every decision you make, however small, will be a step closer to God or a step closer to the devil. When you are unkind to a clumsy shop clerk, you are taking a step closer to the devil. When you snap at your mother, you are taking a step closer to the devil. When you gossip enviously about a friend, you are taking a step closer to the devil. When you go along with the in-crowd and don't speak out against liars, against promiscuity, against abortion, you are taking a step closer to the devil. But it's never too late to stop and begin taking steps toward God. It's a lot easier to make that journey with companions who know the way. Postscript. Good housekeeping kept telling me to make it more personal, which was like telling a dog to make a souffle. I'm a Republican. That column is as personal as it gets. Moreover, I consider a person's view of God, right, wrong, and eternity as eminently personal. What could be more personal than that? In good housekeeping ease, personal seems to mean something involving victimhood and tragedy, or something having more to do with bodily functions. How about my secret shame, why I became a conservative, or how inappropriate touching led me to believe in elimination of the capital gains tax? Alas, I can't write magazine essays about being abused or neglected, because I never had those opportunities. By contrast, Naomi Wolf has them all indexed. Sexual harassment? I got that. The curse and tragedy of being beautiful? I wrote a book about it. How awful men are? Got it right here. The trauma of motherhood? Hold on to your hats. Sadly, my father wasn't a racist, my mother was never arrested, and my brother wasn't a cross-dresser. In other words, I came from a disadvantaged minority background. I'm the product of an intact and loving family. My parents are Caucasian, native-born, English-speaking, happily married, monogamous, and self-supporting. The best word to describe my early family life would be functional. Thus, I had no one to blame but myself when I didn't succeed at something, which in turn led to the dreaded upward spiral known as achievement. Having no one to blame, I had nothing to fall back on my whole life but my native talents. Then again, nobody ever said life was supposed to be fair. I'm a survivor. Several months after my proverb column was rejected, I came across a Good Housekeeping magazine in a waiting room and immediately looked up the proverb column to see exactly what the editors meant by personal. The proverb was, "You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink." The story illustrating this proverb was as follows. The author's son refused to practice his piano lessons, so the author told him he didn't have to take piano lessons anymore, and now he takes harpsichord lessons. Truth be told, the story did create a deep emotional reaction in me. Who do I sue to get that 5 minutes of my life back? At least now I know what personal means. Really, really boring. That may work for good housekeeping, but I'm afraid such columns would not make Ann Coulter, the director's cut.
And now Ann Coulter gives her take on the state of current affairs. What role does editorial opinion have in news reporting?
That's all news reporting is, editorial opinion. Yesterday, the New York Times began a new practice of running wacky conspiracy theories thought up in the editorial room on their front page. When the story about Dick Cheney's doctor being addicted to drugs broke a few weeks ago, some of my friends and I are interested in crazy left-wing conspiracy theorists, in as much as they are dominating the Democratic Party right now. And we started, you know, talking about how, hey, that would make a good conspiracy theory, that the doctor being on drugs will be used as an excuse to drop Cheney from the ticket. That was on the front page of the New York Times yesterday, a crazy conspiracy theory dreamed up by me and two of my friends just casually chatting over the telephone. That's front page news at the Times. You get more facts in my columns, which are opinion columns.
Do you think President Bush will and or should keep Dick Cheney on the ticket with him in November?
Oh, absolutely. This is the fantasy of the New York Times, that he would replace Cheney with John McCain. John McCain is beloved by one group of people, liberals. They're not voting for Bush.
Have you listened to Air America?
Is it still on the air?
Do you think it will have any impact on public opinion and on the upcoming presidential election?
Assuming, and this is a large assumption, that it is still on the air, it will probably persuade all five listeners to vote for John Kerry.
Same-sex marriage. How do you feel about it? And if it happened in your family, would you attend the wedding?
It would be an all-new definition of shotgun wedding. I'm against it.
Fahrenheit 9/11, Michael Moore's movie. Have you seen it? And would you care to comment?
No, I haven't even seen Triumph of the Will yet. I haven't gotten around to that. The thing about Centipede 9/11 or whatever it is that during the Clinton administration, there were a few, you know, offbeat, wacky groups putting out documentaries about how Bill Clinton had killed people and was dealing in drugs. I mean, personally killed people, not just, you know, by the shock and horror of having heart attacks, seeing that this horn dog was in the Oval Office. And conservatives knew about these crazy documentaries, and we never entered them at con. What is it with liberals that their nuttiest conspiracy theorists are their spokesmen now?
So you don't plan to see it?
No, I don't plan to see it.
Governor Schwarzenegger, is he doing a good job?
He's doing a good job, though not a great job. Otherwise, the California legislature would have been terminated. That hasn't happened yet. But no, he's doing a great job considering that he's governor of an insane state that was about to fall into the ocean.
How do you feel about celebrities in public office?
Our celebrities are good and theirs aren't. And the reason for that is, it's universally true. The reason for that is, it's an industry where you don't get ahead by being anti-choice. These people caterwaul about blacklisting in the 50s. Yeah, you go out and announce in Hollywood you are an aspiring actor and you think homosexuality is wrong. See how far that gets you. In an industry that is that Stalinistic and oppressive, anyone who emerges from that and manages to be a Republican isn't just going along with the crowd. So, you know, whatever you can say about conservative Hollywood types, or whatever you can say about the liberal Hollywood types. Okay, maybe they're right. Maybe they're smart. Maybe they're better looking. But the one thing you can't say about them is that they are being courageous.
Political conventions. What do you foresee for 2008 and beyond?
We will keep having political conventions. With any luck, someday the two conventions will be the convention of the moderate Republican Party and the conservative Republican Party.
What is the purpose of the convention besides the nomination of the party's candidate?
It's PR. It gins up the grassroots. The platform committees do perform an actual function. The Democratic Party, for example, never had on its platform anti-lynching legislation when the Republican Party did. The Republican Party platform always comes out for life and so on. The Democratic Party platform is basically a way of faking out the American people. They have to come up with some way to describe their heinous positions for surrender, death, destruction, and pretend that, you know, they're pro-America. So it's mainly just an exercise for the Democrats in hiding what they actually believe. But, you know, it's good to get them on the record, force them to hammer it out.
Why don't more Americans vote?
I think a lot of Americans vote, actually. More than ought to be voting. I don't think there's anything dishonorable about not caring about politics. I think it's dishonorable to know nothing about politics and feel like you're performing some civic duty by going in like a monkey and pulling a lever for one candidate or the other. Encouraging people who do not know what's going on in the world to vote would be like getting me to vote on the Oscars, having, you know, these idiots that rock the vote is always trying to go out and vote. You just randomly are sending monkeys in to pull levers.
President Bush, how is he doing, and how do you think history will view him?
Oh, as a great wartime president, as a great president. They will say he behaved like an adult with the caterwauling of irresponsible and foolish traitors and fatuous idiots, never letting it get to him, defending the country, having the vision and foresight to ensure that when he is written about someday, it will be written in English rather than Arabic.
Despite the book title, Do you count any liberals among your circle of friends?
I'll never tell.
And thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed these unabridged selections from How to Talk to a Liberal, If You Must, The World According to Ann Coulter, by Ann Coulter. This program was produced and directed by Robert Kessler. Executive producer, Sherry Huber. Text copyright 2004 by Ann Coulter. Production copyright 2004, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.